50 years ago today, there was no answer for the disease of alcoholism. 50 years ago, a month from today, the world had had its answer. I've shared with that a little bit. The answer was offered, really, on Mother's Day, and I'm presently reading General Services' Life of Bill, and I tried to see what day of the month Mother's Day was. They have a calendar of events in Bill's life in the back, but they just have Mother's Day 1935. I don't know what day of the month it was itself. I've shared earlier about how we just take this for granted. 50 years ago, if you had bottomed out, there was no answer. Today, there is an answer. What is the answer? I was with Charlie and Joe at a conference at Shangri-La, Oklahoma. They were there and I was talking, and I just really got a perverse pleasure in saying, first, the answer is not the big book, because the big book didn't exist for at least the first 2 years of our program. The answer is not the 12 steps. They didn't exist for at least the first year of our program. The answer basically isn't a God experience, because if it is, we belong in church. If you think of the 6,000 years minimal, rich development of a relationship with God that the Jewish people have, showing my own personal preference, probably best expressed in works of a man named Abram Heschel, who is the single spiritual writer that I most appreciate. He seems to have walked closer with God than anyone I know. Certainly, the Jewish people in their 6,000 years have had the opportunity to understand how to relate with God better than we have in 50 years. If you look at the Christian churches in their 2,000 years or 500 years of spiritual development, they must have a maturity and a richness and insights into relating with God that is far deeper than we have. So if the answer to the disease of alcoholism is a God experience, we're in the wrong place this morning. We really belong in some church, in some synagogue, or some temple. In case any of you are Islam, certainly the very rich, rich development that exists there would be far greater than anything we have in 50 years. The God experience also doesn't really explain our disease from my own experience watching. I've seen people who have experienced God get drunk. I've watched people come back from treatment with their lives totally turned around with a dramatic God experience in treatment, and they were drunk a month later. We had a guy who cursed for years, a complete atheist, coming and getting drunk all the time, went away to treatment, came back, sat down, and with a lot of peace said, "I want to thank God, my sponsor, and Alcoholics Anonymous," in that order. We almost fell off our chairs. And he had such serenity, and he was drunk a month and a half later. I've seen people stay sober without the God experiences. So there's got to be something else to the unique answer of Alcoholics Anonymous. What's our answer? I got my first really real clue by looking at our founders. If you look at Bob and Bill, you see a real good contrast. Bill first had a blinding God experience, said that following that he felt the compulsion to drink just one day in his life. And that was Mother's Day, or the day before Mother's Day, when he started the contacts that put him in touch with Bob. Bill was such a wheeler dealer. Bob, according to him, never lost the desire, and for the first 3 years of his sobriety, didn't lose the compulsion to drink. And he was such a quiet, inward man. What did they have in common? I got the clue from listening to what I call one of the founders' tapes, one of the tapes we have of Bob's life. I had heard it before, but when I was ready, I heard the right thing. And I heard Bob say that he kept his sobriety by working with other alcoholics. I heard Bob say he could judge the quality of his sobriety by how active he was in working with other alcoholics. And when he found himself getting screwed up mentally, he'd stop and think. And sure enough, he wasn't, the way he put it, as active on the wards, and that would be the alcoholic ward of the hospital. They estimate he called on 8 to 12,000 drunks in the 15 years of his sobriety. He sobered up in 35 and died in 50, if I have the dates correct. As I was listening to this, I started seeing our program in a new light. I remembered something I had heard, how Bill needed Bob. Bill sobered up when after Ebby came to see him in November. And Bill started working with drunks, November, December, January, February, March, and April. And he was getting nowhere. And the reason was he was preaching at them, talking down to them. And he went out, drove out to Akron on a business trip, or flew out. The business trip fell apart. He was in the hotel. He saw the bar. The compulsion set in. And he made phone calls instead of going to the bar. And the next day he talked with Bob. And because of the compulsion, he spoke with Bob differently than he'd ever spoken with any of the drunks up until that time. He wasn't talking down to somebody. He was talking to somebody that he needed as desperately as that person needed him. He was sharing one heart to another, one alcoholic to another. And Bob listened because it wasn't being preached to. It was, I think, he was being shared with. Bill needed Bob. When Bob got excited, thought he had an answer, wanted to share it with a medical conference in Atlantic City, came back drunk. On June 10th, his sobriety began and we date our fellowship. Bob and Bill immediately began working with other alcoholics. With that sort of as a background, I looked at our book. And I like to read the book in different ways. First, I went through the book I think I brought here. I brought my favorite one. I went through it and I highlighted all the points I thought were important. No, I underlined in yellow. Then somebody told me that there were more promises than just the promises of the ninth step and the fifth step. And I went through the first 11 chapters and with a red pen, I underlined every promise. There's some negative promises. We will get drunk if we do certain things. They're guarantees. There's a lot of promises all through the rest of the book, though. All through it. All through the 11 chapters. Then I went through the book a third time after I did this, and I underlined all the passages that deal with working with other people. And I was shocked. It's just from just all through it. It's not just in the 12th step. Remember the 7-step prayer. I'm only supposed to ask what will help me be effective to God or to you. Bill says he was taught never to pray for any of his own needs, just for what would make him useful to other people. One of the more surprising examples is when the big book gives us advice on how to deal with our sex problems. And it says, when everything else fails, go work with another alcoholic. And thinking about them will take our minds off our own difficulties. The 12th step receives an entire chapter by itself in the big book. From the 4th step on, it's the only one that has that honor. What then is the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? I believe the message of our fellowship is, and I don't think this is heard very clearly a lot anymore, that an alcoholic stays sober by working with other alcoholics one day at a time. We hear very much that this is a selfish program. If what I've just shared is true, it can't be. In a sense, it is, in that I must put my work and my sobriety ahead of anything else. And I've told the bishop that. AA comes before the Catholic Church very clearly, because if I get drunk, they're going to throw me out. They won't have a functioning drunk priest. AA has to come before family, because if you get drunk, the family is jeopardized. AA must come before children. If you don't know that, I'll tell you, I've listened to fifth steps of people who grew up with drinking alcoholic parents that they buried, and I've touched the hatred that was still in there. And I'd rather have a sober parent gone that I could respect, showing me an answer, than a drunken parent present that I'm hating. So in that sense, the program is selfish in that it must come first. But the program itself is an inherently unselfish program. The primary purpose of our groups is to carry the message. The end result of our steps is to carry the message, as groups and then as individuals. Our program is by its very heart a program in which we go out to other people. Alcoholics, from my experience, who stop sharing eventually lose their sobriety. Continuing to work with other alcoholics is absolutely crucial, and that's why alcoholics who go to church get drunk. because they stop working with other alcoholics. I'm going to tie this into my own experience of God in just a moment. I think that's in here. But first, when I started seeing this, this explained the biggest single riddle of life in Alcoholics Anonymous for me in the first 12 and a half years of my sobriety. I have seen people who seem to have such quality sobriety, such great God experiences, go out and get drunk. And I've seen real farts stay sober. Long time. 20, 30 years. They have nothing that I want. But when I started seeing this, I did some quick looking. And the people with quality sobriety who got drunk had stopped working with other drunks. They didn't stop praying. They didn't stop meditating. They stopped working with other drunks. And the people who have nothing that I want, who have stayed sober for extended periods, every one of them are super active on the 12th step. What I'm going to say is a little bit surprising, and I wouldn't want to stake my life on it, but I kind of believe that you can stay sober on half a step. Not on two steps, on half a step. I believe you can stay sober on the second, or whatever part of it is, of the last one part of the 12th step, working with other alcoholics. I believe that's our answer. I believe that the quality of the sobriety you will have is going to be determined by the remaining program, the other steps that come before. I believe that if you don't work those steps, eventually you will become so miserable that in your misery you're not going to continue to work with other alcoholics and will eventually become drunk. But working the first 11 steps will not offer any sustained sobriety at all. It'll offer serenity. If I'm understanding what happened on Mother's Day 1935 and on June 10th 1935, and if I'm understanding our literature, the answer we have offered the world is the answer to my disease is my working with you. If that is so, then the comments I made when we were dealing with the traditions on what's happening in so many areas where professionals are taking over the work of the average alcoholic in AA is a dangerous thing. As I shared with you, I'm not knocking the professionals. The people staffing the treatment centers will maintain their sobriety if they're working with alcoholics. But those of us who allow them to do our work, we're the ones who are going to get drunk. The people who are filled with their sponsoring are going to stay sober. But the people who aren't sponsoring, who are allowing a select few to do all the sponsoring, who never walk up to a newcomer and say, "I want to be your temporary sponsor," they're not going to sustain their sobriety. The people who listen to the fifth steps, they'll stay sober. But the people who send others, because if you're carrying the message, I think you'll stay sober. The people who won't listen to fifth steps, they're losing the blessings and the benefits. And I can fit this very easily into my own experience of God. And so the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Let me go back to the story I'm talking about, walking on top of the water. If I'm up here on top of the water and I see you down there drowning, and I know I have the ability to reach a hand down and offer you the means by which, not to lift you, but offer you the means by which you two can join me on top of the water. And after a year or 5 years or 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, I get tired doing this and I figure, well, you know, I've been up here long enough, helping people long enough. I'm going to go watch television. Because watching television is more exciting than offering you life. I owe rest to myself. Somehow, can I really be appreciating the miracle that's occurring to me if I turn my back on you and let you drown? And it's very difficult for me under those circumstances to picture God sustaining me on top of the water much longer. I don't care how many years I've done it. The only important thing is today, this surprise that I'm on top of the water and looking at you and seeing that you're hurting. And if I somehow can help you, what greater excitement could there be than that? I remember a gal that was a good friend of mine, one of the most active members of AA. She came from a very, very devout, fundamental religious family. And after about 5 years working in AA, sponsoring and just helping more people at that time than anybody else in Oklahoma City that I knew, she decided she wanted to study Scripture so she could be active in Scripture studies instead. And I couldn't understand that. Because see, I go to church on Sunday morning and I see so many people's faces hurting and I can't help them. I know there's an answer, but they're not ready for the answer. And I just sit at an AA meeting and people save my life and I save their life and we keep each other on top of the water. And it just astounded me then and it astounds me today how anybody would trade the reality of life and walk away from that just to study the Scriptures. I love the Scriptures, but I'm not going to put them before your living. And the excitement that I can get if I can be part of helping you live and stay sober. If the 11th step is being loved, the principle of the 12th step is loving. Let me review the principles up to this point. I begin with terror. Terror in myself and in alcohol. I respond to that with confidence in what God can do. I then experience relief as I turn myself over to the care of God. I have self-awareness of who I am. I have openness about who I am. I experience a wholeness, accepting myself as a person, just one person, not a series of traits, a wholeness. I have cooperation with God. God will not do for me alone what I must cooperate with Him in having done. I then have enough inner strength, I'm almost lifting my hand too high, got to take it slower, to be aware of you as people, so I have other awareness. With this, I offer a healing of any obstacles that I've placed between us. I realize I must be responsible and regular in living these principles. I'm now ready to be loved by God through you, and I in turn can love God through you. Those are the principles that we can practice, that I can practice in all my affairs at any moment, in traffic jams, in relationships, in homes, and at meetings. This is the completion of being loved. It enables me to cooperate with a God who is love. It completes the circle of love. You know, love must love. And if God loves me and I take that love and I keep it and watch you drown, I kill God in me. God must love. And if God sees you hurting, somehow He must reach out and want to love you through me. And if filled with His love, I walk away from you, I've got to experience Him because He cannot not love. And so I somehow must allow the circle to be complete. Having had a spiritual awakening, that's different from a spiritual experience. Experience is sort of an emotional flash. An awakening is a lasting state. Not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has spiritual experiences. Everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who works the 12 steps will become spiritually awake. Sometimes they don't even know what's happening, but they're awake. I've seen that happen in my own sponsoring. Some people have many experiences. I've had some great ones. My very first one was the first big state conference in Oklahoma City that I attended. I didn't know it was happening. I was in this room with 1,200, 1,300, or 1,400 Al-Anons and alcoholics, so many friends. We're all together. We stood to say the Our Father. I was up front, and I was just knocked off my feet by a spirit of prayer that united all of us together. That's just fabulous. I've never heard men pray like that before. Usually in churches, women will pray, and, you know, men are kind of shy. But ours is just a whole different kind of spirit. That was an experience for me. I remember I went to a retreat, the young people's, and had a powerful experience. I was at a sort, this was an AA, I call it a retreat. It was a very close conference. I went to sort of an AA camp conference at Brownwood, Texas. And I found myself blurting out something that's in the Bible. I started saying, "Boy, Lord, it's good to be here." And that's an exact phrase. Somebody in the Bible has a mountaintop experience, and he says, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. Let's build some tents to stay here." But that exactly tells me the difference between experiences and awakenings. Some of us get experiences, mountaintop experiences, so that when we walk down in the valleys, we'll have the memory of the mountain to walk us through the darkness of the valley and the pain of the valley. They can't last. Experiences are, by their very nature, very emotional. Try to stay on a spiritual high when you got the flu and you're sitting on the toilet. It's impossible, and people forget that. And it's very real. You can't sustain a body emotion forever. The body has its fluctuations. You can have a spiritual awakening sitting on a toilet. You can have an inner sense of peace and being loved, but you're not going to have a spiritual. I won't have a spiritual high. Maybe you can. I won't. Basically, part of the danger of spiritual experiences are that they're so neat that people try to hold on to them, and you can't. They're going to go. And if I try to hold on it, I start getting desperate, and then I go down into a depression. Let me share something else that may help you. Spiritual experiences and anything good. People want to go back to their spiritual experiences. You can never go back in life. If you have liked this weekend, and you return to it next year, and you try to go back to this weekend, you're going to screw it all up. I do that again and again. My second state conference was lousy because I try to go back to my first, and they changed the whole thing. Different speakers, different spirit, different everything. My second Young People's in Whitney, Texas was terrible because I try to go back to my first. You can never go back or stay still in life. You can only go forward. You can't go back to where you sobered up because it's not there anymore. Even if all those same people who are your close friends are still there, they're not there. They've grown. They've changed. They're new people. They have new relationships. They're new people inside. You can never go back in life. You can only go forward. You can't go back spiritually. What we experienced in our childhood, our spiritual childhood, is not what we need in our spiritual teens and in our spiritual young adulthood and in our spiritual maturity. Early in spiritual life, there's a lot of emotions. This is from my own life, and I think from the life watching of other people. As we grow, spiritual experiences get less emotional, and the spiritual life gets less emotional, but the inner quiet of the presence of God gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And the people I know who are my real giants, 20 to 25 years into our program, growing a lot, they're not people on spiritual highs. They're not not spiritual highs. They've got a quiet to them. It's like they're filled with love. But they're not bubbling, dynamic, and just all charged and high-tense people like I am and other people are. They've just got this inner quiet that has just developed and developed and developed. That's from being spiritually awake. These experiences, if you have spiritual experiences, have their place. And as I shared, that's to pull us through the pain. They're sort of like a cloud nine. Not everybody in AA has a cloud nine. I had one. Cloud nines, a lot of us, when we sober up, we go immediately into a high. I'll tell you something. I hope most of you, if you're new here, don't have a cloud nine. Most of the people I know with cloud nines have trouble sustaining their sobriety. They come in, you take the alcohol out, they feel so good. Like me, you go shooting up. When you feel good, you don't have to work the steps. Why work a fourth step? Why, when I'm feeling so good, threaten it by getting out a sheet of paper and looking at what is unpleasant in my life? And so I've seen so many people shoot up, sustain a high, and put off doing the steps, and then all of a sudden they start slipping down. And I don't know what happens, but most of them, when they start to slip, it's too late. You know, the time to build a dam is not in the middle of a tornado. It's too late. You're going to have the flood. And it seems, you know, the time to build the dam is when it's dry. That's when you move all the earth and build up your dams. Then when the rains come, you can hold it back in a reservoir and it doesn't flood over. When we start slipping down, sometimes it's too late. And they try the AA program at that point and they say, AA didn't work for me. I tried it. They didn't try it on the cloud nine. I'm one of the very few lucky people who coasted through a cloud nine. And then after it started ending, started working the rest of the steps and somehow was able to stay sober. I don't know why. I wasn't to blame because I came into a bad group and nobody pushed the program. They had the most dangerous thing of two dangerous things. They said the cafeteria thing. Oh, the steps are there. Just take the ones you want and leave the rest. And then the other thing was even worse. They said the way you weren't, when you worked the third step, you stopped. And the sign that you got to when you should start the fourth step is when you felt absolutely horrible. Until that time, you enjoyed the third step. So you sat on any step you did until you felt absolutely horrible, then you did the next one. And that's the kind of trash that I was introduced to in Alcoholics Anonymous, and fortunately was taken to a big book group in Texas where I met the real program and then started my own sobriety. So emotional experiences, if you don't have a lot, cloud nines, if you didn't have one, they're not necessarily any loss. The awakening is a loss. See, the spiritual awakening's for everybody. It's there. It's guaranteed. It's in the program. It can begin suddenly the way it did for Bill, and I woke up 3 weeks sober, and I just was a different person inside, and I've never been the same person since. It can begin dramatically like that, but it doesn't have to, and it doesn't do it dramatically for everybody. But everybody comes awake. Most people have it very gradual. I describe the spiritual awakening that most people have like the very slow lifting of a fog. You don't even notice that it happens when it first starts. The fog starts burning away, and all of a sudden you see a tree, and you didn't even know you were looking at the tree. Then you see the next tree behind it. And that's how most people become spiritually awake. It's promised by the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result, why do we work the 12 steps? The 11 steps. We work the 11 steps to become spiritually awake. That's the, not a, result. The result. Very often, we're the last person to see that we're spiritually awake. There's a new power in us. We're able to do what we couldn't do before. We're able to live sober. We're able to live. We know a joy, a serenity, and a friendship that we've never known before. I can see this as sponsoring, as a sponsor. I look at people I sponsor who think they're going nowhere. They're walking through a crisis. And so they're emotionally upset, and I'm flabbergasted at the strength they're showing. Someone who's never, ever been able to stand up to a wife is nailing her to the wall, feeling hell at doing it, and thinking nothing's happening. And there's such a new spiritual power, it's unbelievable. It's such a healthy relationship for both of them. And he feels like hell, so he thinks he's falling apart, and as a sponsor, I'm applauding like mad. Somebody who's walked through a lot of pain, a drug addict, goes through a horrendous crisis, has a sober alcoholic husband returned to drinking, has a sober alcoholic son returned to drinking, has a daughter walking through crisis, and she's carrying all of them. And she thinks that there's nothing happening in her life. When 8 years before she was a vegetable, she couldn't live in any way. Now she's carrying the problems of three people, also going to Al-Anon to learn how to release them, but she's walking drug-free, and she's an example to them that there's an answer, and she's smiling. And we don't know what's happening. I remember one person, I had one gal I sponsored, called me up right before November and said, I just went out and scored some drugs. I'm going to hold them. And if the program has to work until December 1st, and if it doesn't work by then, I'm going to do my drugs. She's a very good friend of mine. I went through hell for a moment, knew she was doing what she's supposed to. And if you were here earlier, you have me believing, remember, that if I'm doing what I'm told by my sponsor, and my sponsor is telling me to do what the program tells me to do, and I'm carrying the message, God will not allow me to get drunk. That's the strongest test I've ever seen of that. God had until December 1st. In the middle of January, she was on such a spiritual high, you couldn't believe it. She doesn't know how she got from November to January. And she wasn't aware even of the change. She forgot November by January. And I gently took her back to November to show her what God was doing, how spiritually awake she had been, and how God was really carrying her, the footprints in the sand in November, so completely and so alone when she didn't believe he existed at all. 13 years ago in April, I couldn't live with alcohol and pills. Now I'm living without them. That doesn't mean I haven't known any pain. I have. I've had depressions. I've had anguish. I've had anger. I've had fear. I've had lust. I've had greed. I've had so many different kind of difficulties, some from things within me, but many more from problems that come from without. As I shared with you, I've even cursed God. My inventory can help me see that I'm becoming awake spiritually, that I'm able to do things I couldn't do before. This spiritual awakening can begin with the fifth step. That's where it's kind of promised, that at this point we start becoming spiritually awake. I was lucky. Mine began within 3 weeks after the third step. God can short-circuit and give us touches of things before. I woke up one morning, and in the deepest core of my being, I didn't hate being Larry. I'd never, ever had that before. And I've only lost that for 5 days since, and that was on the end of a long dry drunks each time, and I knew exactly what I had to do to get it back, and I did it, and I got it back. This guarantee isn't a small point. It's the power of the steps and the principles. You work these steps and you're going to have a spiritual awakening, whether you believe in God or not. Bob White said something that I don't ever think he put on a tape. I don't know if everybody ever heard him say this. It's one of the most powerful things that I've ever heard in AA, and I believe it. If you're new, listen to this. If you're old, listen to this. He said, give us your body. Keep the rest. Do whatever with it that you want. Give us your body 100%. You will never drink again, and you will come to know God and peace. Give us your body means you do every single thing we tell you. Keep all the rest. Think it's stupid, think it's dumb, feel superior, feel smarter. Resist all you want inside. Just do every single thing we tell you. And you're going to have a spiritual awakening. That's what the 12 steps guarantee. And I believe that. I believe that 100%. From my own experience, the only thing I've surrendered was my body. I've kept the rest. And when I sponsor somebody, that's what I want from them. And it's so funny. You know, if a woman sits down and she takes a recipe and there's five things on it, and she puts those five things in, or 10 or 12, to make a chocolate cake, and she does everything she's told, and she comes out of the oven with a chocolate cake. She doesn't go, oh, I got a chocolate cake. It's what you're supposed to get. You do steps 10, 1 through 11, you're going to be spiritually awake. And we're shocked. We stress it so little. The opposite of that is true. If she puts 8 of the 10 things in there, and she doesn't get a chocolate cake, or it's like a flat little chocolate pancake, she doesn't rile and scream, I'm being cheated. You know, you do 3 steps, or 5 steps, or 9 steps, or 10, and you're not spiritually awake. Or 10 and a half, and you're not spiritually awake. Don't be surprised, you haven't completed the recipe. It's an 11-step recipe to the spiritual awakening. That's what it was for me, and that's what it is as I see it in the steps themselves for me. I'm preaching, I'm sorry. I'm accustomed to do that on Sunday mornings. Keep the collection away from me. I've done weird things with that on Sunday mornings too. When I tell them about stealing every cent in the poor fund, you know, no AA group I've ever been in has elected me a treasurer since that. It's so sad that with a guaranteed spiritual awakening, so many alcoholics turn elsewhere for serenity. They go to a doctor for sleeplessness, a psychiatrist for anxiety, first. Not eventually, first. And that's the sad part. I believe that if I tried the program, I can then go to therapy for anything that I want. I want you to know I have no war with therapy at all. I think right now there's 2 people I'm counseling who are going regularly to therapy. I lay down rules for it. First, I point out a grave danger. Therapy is an easier, softer way. And so it's very easy to switch from the program to therapy and make the therapy everything and push out the program. The second thing I try to tell them is they've got to put AA first. They have to commit, and they have to tell me they're following all their commitments. They're making their regular meetings. They're doing their daily inventory. They're doing their 5 to 15 minute meditation, and they're calling me regularly. The next thing, they cannot take any mood-changing medication from a doctor or a psychiatrist. I don't care what they say. They just can't take it. This is different from psychoses. I'm talking about the ones for just upset. I have no reservations with a psychotic taking the medication they get. I want to put this as an aside, because in a group this large, we probably have several people who have psychoses. I sponsored a drug addict who was also a psychotic. Every other drug he abused. Most psychotics don't like taking the drug that they're told to take that handles the psychosis. A psychosis usually is a chemical imbalance in the brain. And the medication they get just corrects that imbalance. It doesn't make them feel better. As soon as they start feeling better, they want to stop taking it. And I had to fight this guy to keep him taking his drug for his psychosis, and then try to keep them from taking all the others. So what I'm sharing has nothing to do with that if you're going to see a psychiatrist. That's an area I don't have any confidence in at all. The last thing is I've got to be given all instructions. And I do this, as I told you also, if somebody goes to an Al-Anon sponsor. Let me tell you why all advice must be run through me. The reason for this is, supposing I move into an apartment and I don't know anything about how to clean a sink. And I go to 2 women who are friends of mine and say, boy, my sink is filthy. One woman says, scratch it, fill it with Clorox. and let it soak a while, and that'll take some of the stains out. And the other woman just heard me mention I had a dirty sink, and she says, Larry, I hear you have a dirty sink. Fill it with ammonia and let it soak a while, and it'll clean it out. So I fill the sink 80% filled with water, and then I put in 2 cups of Clorox and 2 cups of ammonia, and I stand over the sink to watch it work. Some of you know science. I'm going to die. I have just created a deadly gas by mixing 2 good elements alone. That can happen with advice from 2 sponsors, advice from a sponsor and a psychiatrist. That you got an obstacle and you got to get around it. The psychiatrist says go around it to the right. The AA sponsor says go around it to the left. You try to do it both ways and you get spiritually herniated. And you can't handle it. So all the advice must be triggered through something, through a person. It's so sad that with a guaranteed form of spiritual awakening, we do go elsewhere. But anyhow, a spiritual awakening is the result. It's certainly not what I wanted. When I came here, I wanted money, I wanted youth, I wanted health, I wanted sex, I wanted power, I wanted fans, I wanted prestige, I wanted adoration. I was given love. It's the only thing the program guarantees. It doesn't guarantee we're going to be rich. A lot of alcoholics earn a lot of money. A lot of good alcoholics just seem to have financial difficulties in the program. Just because you're working the steps doesn't mean they're never going to close down your factory or your plant or your job and you're never going to be put out of work. Most alcoholics, given love, are you able to unite their families? Some alcoholics lose their families. Sometimes the alcoholic gets sober and the Al-Anon can't take it. Sometimes the Al-Anon gets sober and the alcoholic isn't able to take it. And the Al-Anon has to watch, working a good program, the alcoholic walk out. With God consciousness, a God awareness, the awareness of being loved, I can endure anything. I've discovered what I needed is definitely not what I wanted. I'm going to take a moment and put a footnote in. This, again, has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. I was going to start this talk with it. There's one thing I've seen that I almost never hear shared that may be very important. And it's the unhealthy use of sex that so many of us have. It's epidemic in our programs. Sex can be used for pleasure. You know about that. You know, just I'll take the extreme. If it's you and the horse, it's not because you love the horse or you like the horse. It's because of pleasure. Sex can be used because you like the person. No real love. 2 teenagers romantic with each other, you know, they don't love each other. They go out on a date and they have intercourse. Sex can be used for love. The wife, because of problems in her own background, doesn't climax, and she she's in a part right now just for a brief period where she's feeling kind of empty, and she'll even ask the husband if he would like intercourse because she wants him to be happy. Now, those are all different. They can gather alone. They can be in combinations. Sex is also used very, very often by alcoholics as an expression of self-destruction. Self-destruct is the single most universal trait that I've found in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. And it's one that stays in our happiness. When we get healthy, it stays in our sobriety. As a matter of fact, it is more likely to pop its head up when things are going well. That's when I order the people that I sponsor to really look in their inventories, their daily inventories, because if they're like me, they're going to be doing something to screw up their happiness. Often it's sexual, but not always. It can be done in other areas. The guy gets his wife mad so that she divorces him. He acts like a jackass on the job so that he gets fired because everything was just going too perfect. But in sex, let me show you some ways. I have a guy who, drug addict that I sponsored, who was told by his parole officer 1.5 years early, you don't have to check in with me anymore. That week, the guy started window peeping. Now, he has so much going for him in looks and personality, he can get whatever he wants. And I mean window peeping from the window. 1 year later, he had a letter hit our governor's desk for a full pardon. He was window peeping again. The year and a half after that, he was in just making money in a good profession. He was window peeping all the time. He was doing it to get caught, and he got caught. Now he's facing bankruptcy. He doesn't window peep at all because nothing's going well. He's got other pain. I had another friend who, every time a lot of heavy things happened in his wife, either went to a prostitute or put the make on a gal, and whatever the gal he picked was, that gal had a direct connection to his wife. And he was a student at the time. He was going to the prostitutes on a limited budget. And I looked at him and I said, someday your wife's going to learn how to add. But that's what he wanted. He was begging to be discovered. What he didn't know was his need to be discovered was only outdone by her need not to see. She buried her head deeply enough in the sand so she wouldn't see it, because if she saw it, she'd have to take action she didn't want to take. My self-destruct shows itself most obviously with porno. When I was at the high school, this is not what I got fired for, you'd really understand getting fired. Catholic high school teaching, I went to a hardcore porno shop 2 blocks from the high school, parked my car time after time and went in it to buy the porno. If anybody had ever seen my car there, I'd have been fired. And I would know that this is crazy, and yet like a compulsion it hit. It's just the craziness, and it's an element of my own sexual life. It's that part of my sexual life that is self-destructive. So watch for that in your sexual pattern. That's harmful to you. And if the program's building you up and you have a sex pattern that's risking all your life, that's risking your respect. I first saw this by a friend of mine who had had animal sex, grew up, matured, but every time he really hated himself, he'd go to have animal sex again, and it was a way of destroying his own self-respect. We deserve better than that. He deserves better than that. The program would lift him up and he would try to destroy it. Coming back to the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message. What's this message? The message is me. The message is you, that I'm spiritually awake. In order to show you that I'm spiritually awake, it's important that you know what I was, so that you can appreciate what I am today and can see the connection of what has happened. Therefore, I share my failure so that you can understand that God is responsible for my success. And so we discuss affairs and lost children and beaten spouses. Not because we're shameless, but because it's what's needed for other people to understand what's happening in our life today. I tell you I can hug myself. So what? A lot of people can hug themselves. But if you put it in the light of how I grew up hating everything that I was, and I tell you that I can hug myself in love, then you understand that's part of the message that I am, the spiritual awakening that can't flow from me. Somebody with my feelings about me cannot enjoy hugging themselves as an experience. I began with my hurts. Let me take a moment now to kind of conclude the start of this whole talk. I told you how I felt physically ugly, emotionally guilty, intellectually insane, religiously damned, and socially isolated. I'm going to go back and refer to each of those. About a year and a half ago, I was in Jonesboro, Arkansas, at a conference. But after one of the talks, everybody got together, locked arms, and someone sang the Lord's Prayer, not in a showy way. While it was being sung, the only thing that I did was picture my face. I had never been able to picture my face before in my life because I felt so physically ugly. And slowly, your accepting me in love allowed me to accept my own looks. That's one of the greatest things that's ever happened. I think I may have told you, see, I shaved and never saw what was in the mirror. I just blocked it out. But I don't have to block it out. And it told me that you've loved me enough. Your love gradually has just been coming in, so I don't feel physically ugly anymore. Oh, I have waves of physical ugliness, but I'm growing out that point. I don't feel emotionally guilty anymore, not always. I can hug myself. 4 years sober, I heard about this, and I took a whole year working on it. But when I'm doing this now, I mean it. I'm embracing myself. I like me. Parts of me at times, all of me at other times, and I love me. Parts of me at times and all of me at times. And this is an embrace that is meant for me to me. And it's also my giving myself God's hug for me. I don't really feel I'm going to end my life permanently committed in a mental hospital anymore. I don't really think that. Yeah, I've got some nutty actions, but basically I have a healthiness in my own life. I don't feel religiously damned. I'm sober. I'm a miracle. I'm the beloved of God. I don't feel socially isolated anymore. I have a purpose in life. Some suffering alcoholic needs to hear me. That's why I'm still alive. It's not important that you accept me. It's important that I offer myself to you. That's my purpose. I don't carry the person. I carry the message. And that's my purpose in life. I made a reference to never hearing anybody talk about midlife crisis, and I described my own midlife crisis. Steps 11 and 12 were my answer. In meditation, I experienced, I'm not a failure. I'm the beloved of God. In the 12th step, I remembered my purpose. 47 going nowhere in the Catholic Church, so what? If I look out on Sundays, I see that I'm spinning my wheels anywhere. Anyway, but there is somewhere a drowning alcoholic that I can reach down to and offer them the means to come up and stand on top of the water. And how can I be a midlife failure? I'm the beloved of God, crucially important in life. And that got me out of it. Now, I still will occasionally wave back into it when I pick up our diocese. I should never read anything the bishop sends out because it's just opening old wounds. And they're open for a moment, and I see how everybody else is going up and I'm staying down. But then, you know, that's not where my answer is. I don't get the answer from there. I get the answer from within. We tell what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now. So many alcoholics don't do that. They say what it was like, what happened, and what it's been like at a good moment recently. You know, a lot of people only say what it was like in their talks. It's like they, rather than share their experience, strength, and hope, they just share their experience. And maybe that's because they don't have much strength or hope. And it might be better if they waited a while until they got some strength and hope that they could share. But it's important that I show everything to you so you understand the miracle. I'm sober, so is my mother. It's surprising for me. It's a miracle for me. And it's important for me to tell all of me that I am about you so that you can see this. And when you understand again that 12, almost 13 years sober, a month short of that, how much of my sobriety I've wasted, how I'm so much sicker than other people, and yet I've been able to stay above the water, then you can understand something of the power of God that's available in our fellowship and available to you. We tried to carry the message, not the person. There's a variety of ways we can carry the message to alcoholics, not just to drunks, but to alcoholics. And that includes alcoholics hurting in the program. And so I can carry the message by sponsoring. I can carry the message by speaking formally and informally. I can carry the message by serving. I can carry the message by doing coffee, by cleaning up an AA clubhouse. I can carry the message by charity. I carry the message by sponsoring, and let me remind you just for me how I sponsor. And I want to again go into the chocolate and strawberry. You've heard me share some of the ideas of my sponsoring. It'd be horrible if you took the whole picture of how I sponsor and try to apply it. Because you see, the people that you sponsor didn't ask me to be their sponsor. They asked you to be their sponsor. And that's very important. If they want me to be their sponsor, they're going to call me. The people who sponsor people, those haven't called me, they've called them. And they sponsor in different ways. And it rubs my grain, and I'm ever ready to say something because they'll bring sponsorship problems to me in this, that's part of their own need for advice. And I'm very careful not to interfere with their ways of sponsoring at all, just to listen and to help them find the answer they should. You know, just recently it occurred to me that so many of you sponsor, it's the most dangerous thing you will ever do in your life. You realize that? You're toying with the life of another person. You're toying with the life of a very sick person. And it is life and death. And if you give one wrong answer, they're likely to die. But we do it. Don't get upset. Please don't run off into an anxiety attack about this. This is one of the greatest little things where we're spiritually awake. We don't sweat about it. Somebody else comes up after the first or second time and says, "Will you be my sponsor?" We say, "Okay." If I ever thought about what could happen if I made a wrong decision, I'd never be able to sponsor. See, all I got to do is listen to the person, and this to me is the single biggest instance of the 9-step promise. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Somebody calls me, and I'm like a marshmallow. The next person calls me, and I'm like steel. And I don't know why, but it's just what they need. And God tells me things that I never think of to share with people. My own sponsor has told me that I'm one of the most complex people he's ever sponsored. And I come to him with deep, deep, deep difficulties, and he doesn't know where the answers come from. They're just there. He intuitively knows how to handle situations that used to baffle him. We carry this message to alcoholics who suffer, not to drunks. We should be aware of their suffering after the eighth step. Remember, that's so important. It helps me become in tune with where you're at. Sometimes we forget this. I sit in an AA meeting and I hurt very badly because somebody will ask a question from pain and the next three speakers have already canned their speeches. And they just give their canned speeches, and they're done to impress all of us. I do this all the time, so I'm not knocking at. But the person in hurt is just hanging there. Somebody's exposed to pain, and they're just ignored. And at a meeting like that, I break in. We're not listening. We've got a suffering alcoholic who has asked for help. And I'll go in and I'll share my own experience. Not give advice, but share my own experience. People will say there's no such thing as a bad 12-step call, because everyone they've ever called on, they themselves have never gotten drunk. I don't agree with that at all. I'm not dependent on your reception, but I've made, most of my 12-step calls have been bad. You see, I'm supposed to say what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now. From the podium, when I'm sponsoring, when I'm talking to you across the table, when I'm talking to you individually. Most of the time, I don't want to do that. I don't want you to know where I'm at right now. I could be planning to buy some porno, planning some kind of sex escapade, planning to just charge something to the church that shouldn't be. And I don't want to tell you that when I'm still planning it. That's not a nice place to be. I'm planning one of those right now. I ain't going to tell you which one. You're too young. You don't have your mother's permission. I'm happy I got that out. I wondered how I would be able to share that. That happened well. I couldn't leave here without telling you that. And I want to tell that to you. I want to tell you how nice it's been. And it has been a wonderful evening, a wonderful weekend. I have never, ever seen as much courtesy and kindness in Alcoholics Anonymous as you people have shown. You've just been warmer. You've just been more open. You've just been more grateful than any group I've ever been with. And that's been from the first talk right on. You know, you just have loved me to death. You know, you've loved me to enough energy that I could just enjoy what I've been doing so, so very, very much. So I've been in a good place most of the time, and I didn't have to share being in a lot of pain. But I've made many bad 12-step calls. You see, if I don't share myself with you on any of these levels, you may not hurt. I may have told you enough about AA. But when I walk away, I don't feel better. I walk away feeling, yeah, but if he really knew, if she really knew, if they really knew. And I walk away feeling cheaper. And so I make a lot of bad 12-step calls because I'm trying to impress. That happened so much in the place where I sobered up. And it is so very, it was so very, very difficult. Because it seemed like nobody ever had a bad day. And I was 9 months sober, and I drove 150 miles to Dallas to talk to somebody because I was depressed. And nobody in my group ever talked about depression. And somebody played a Clancy tape for me. And I was in heaven for the first time in my life with Clancy, and I've never lost my respect since. It was the tape where he washed dishes for that long period. You know, he was sober for 6 months, living in the back seat of a car, got his first job. And the guy fires him after 3 days, washing dishes, this top executive. Fired after 3 days working a spiritual program. He comes up and he says, "You can't fire me. You don't understand. I'm working, trying to save my life. I'm working this spiritual program." And the guy says, "I don't know anything about your spiritual program, kid. You just don't wash enough goddamn dishes." And Clancy decided to kill himself walking in the ocean. And as he says, as he remembered, a star is born, the version that those of us who are older saw when James Mason walked into the ocean far enough and drowned himself. And he says he walked 4 to 10 miles parallel to the ocean. Called his sponsor and was told to start his fourth step. This guy spawns, and he's sober, and he's sober when all this is happening longer than I was when I heard it, and I was at home. And it was his sharing his pain that did so much for me. I'm afraid at the moment, to wrap up the whole picture of where I'm at, I'm afraid to commit to the church because I've been hurt so much, and I'm unable to leave it. I found that out when I tried to leave it and just couldn't accept not serving friends in certain ways. I'm in an assignment where I'm doing absolutely nothing. This may be the thing I'm least liking about myself. There's no demands, and I'm getting lazy. And it's, you know, when you're doing nothing, it's very difficult to try to picture doing something. I have moments of sexual quiet and sexual arousal, and I judge myself very, very deeply and negatively when I'm in the periods of sexual arousal. And yet I'm sober. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor. You know, I enjoy talking out of town. But what I really respect myself for is being regular on my regular meetings where, you know, they don't treat me any damn differently than the newest drunk in the place. They don't give me the respect I deserve. Thank God, and that saves my own life, and I can just share with them. Now, that's what happens to me. Having had a spiritual awakening, that's where I'm at right now. We try to carry this message. You've heard where I'm at right now. You've heard where I began. You've heard what God has done in the interim in those areas of hurt. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to Al-Anons. And let me just briefly share, because this did come up. You've heard me talk about Al-Anons a lot. Very often, we're very haughty in what we say about Al-Anons. And I think, you know, I don't know why other people would do that, and I may have been in my own life. That is no place in our fellowship. That is no place in love. That is no place in an organization where we've received so much from Al-Anons. I've told you that every healthy thing I know about tough love, I've caught by listening to Al-Anons in our program. And that was before I discovered I had the Al-Anon traits. They don't come to AA meetings to be hurt any more than we come to AA meetings to be hurt. And they come with their defenses down often. And we can wound them as easily as we can wound each other before they can get their defenses back down. And the 8 steps should help us be sensible and alive and alert to the feelings and the needs that they have. They're God's children as well as we have. As a matter of fact, in honesty, I feel some of them had to suffer more than we did. And I will use this term, sicker, because they had the same pains I did, but for whatever reason, alcohol didn't work for them. I took the drink and it exploded. I took the pill and felt good. They took the drink and it didn't do that magic for them. So while I was falling apart and alcohol could at least hold me together, they were falling apart and there was nothing there for long periods to hold them together. I'm not anything because of my drinking. I am everything that I am healthy today because of the program. They have this same program. And we can't just look down our nose at them because they weren't alcoholics. If they're working the program, I've gone to Al-Anons for spiritual advice and for directions on the steps. And I've received some very important advice in my own life. If they're working the steps as healthily as we are, they will be as healthy as we are, if not more. We try to practice these principles, and I'll go through them one last time. I begin with terror, absolute terror at the blackness of alcohol. I'm powerless over it, and my life's unmanageable. I'm going to drink again. The second step offers me confidence at any moment that handles the terror. Confidence that has nothing to do with me, that has to do with God. The third step is relief as I'm in the care of God. I picture the third step as sort of my resting in the hands of God, sort of the Allstate commercial. I'm just snuggled up in the hands of God. The fourth step, I become as aware as possible who I am. It's self-awareness. And I see that God is keeping me, the very human, real person, sober. The fifth step, I have the openness to share everything I've been hiding from the world with you through the strength of God. The sixth step, I stand as a person, not as a group of traits. I'm Larry. I'm not lush priest. I'm Larry. I'm a person. And I try to be me in your presence. The seventh step, I want to cooperate with God as he loves me as the person I am at this moment. The eighth step, I have now the strength to become aware of where you are at, other awareness. The ninth step, because I'm aware of where you're at and I see what God has done for me, I want to heal any obstacles that will keep me from helping you. The tenth step, I know how important it is from those who have gone back to drowning for me to be responsible and regular in what I'm doing. The 11th step, I'm ready now to be loved. And the 12th step, I love. I close most of my solemn formal talks with the same story. Story from the Gospel of John. I don't care if you believe in the Gospel, the Bible at all. That's not important. I hope you'll hear the application. The Lord had a friend die, and after 3 days he came to the place where the friend was buried. And he stood outside the tomb and he called the friend from death to life. And the friend came out and he was wrapped with thin little strips. And then this is what I want you to hear. The Lord said to the people around, untie him and let him walk free. This little story, on whatever level you hear it, maybe will help you as it does me keep in perspective Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Overeaters Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and God. You have not called me from death to life. You have not called me from light, from darkness to light. You have not called me from drunkenness to sobriety. Only my God can do that. You may have been the vehicle, but only my God can offer me my sobriety. But when he gave me sobriety, he didn't give me freedom. It's a real mystery. I was crippled. I told you all the hurts that I had when I came to the fellowship. I couldn't walk at all. I couldn't leave my room. And God didn't give me the ability to walk. He gave me to you, and he said, untie him and let him walk free. And you loved me, and you accepted me again and again and again. And the longer you have loved me and the more you've accepted me, the more you've removed those bonds. And it took a long time, and I started crawling. And then I took a few little haltering steps. And then I took some very strong steps. And once or twice I've been able to love, to run and to walk. You have restored me to life. I was given to you, and I was given to you to be unbound, and you unbound me. Maybe this week and in this sharing may unbind some of you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.